The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I want to talk this evening about bringing our lives alive, and in particular through the practice of doing less, and the practice in particular of being less attached or activated by fear, by our fears. And as I was thinking about that topic this afternoon, I was remembering there's a line from the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra is one of the kind of primary texts in Zen and in all of Buddhism. And there's a line that says, without any hindrances, no fears exist. Without any hindrances, no fears exist. And it's interesting, that announcement about Gil kind of addressing there are the various, five hindrances, sometimes six hindrances, sloth being one of them. But the Heart Sutra, is a translation for the Prajna Paramita, which is a sutra, words of the Buddha about wisdom and wisdom beyond wisdom. And I want to start by, I want to read from the prologue to, this is a book that is hot off the presses, called Less, or Accomplishing More by Doing Less. And I want to just read a few paragraphs from the prologue. Actually, this starts with a quote by Mark Twain that says, "Having lost sight of our goals, we redouble our efforts." Having lost sight of our goals, we redouble our efforts. There's an old story of a man riding very fast on a horse. As he rides past his friend standing on the side of the road, the friend yells, "Where are you going?" The rider turns toward his friend and yells, "I don't know. Ask the horse." This is a description of what many of our lives are like. Right? The pace and intensity of our lives, both at work and at home, leave many of us feeling like that person riding a frantically galloping horse. Our daily incessant busyness, too much to do, and not enough time, the pressure to produce a to-do list and tick off items by each day's end, seems to decide the direction and quality of our existence for us. But if we approach our days in a different way, we can consciously change this out-of-control pattern. It requires only the courage to do less. This may sound easy, but doing less can actually be very hard. Too often we mistakenly believe that doing less makes us lazy and results in a lack of productivity. Instead, doing less helps us savor what we do accomplish. We learn to do less of what is extraneous and engage in fewer self-defeating behaviors. So we craft a productive life that we truly feel good about. Just doing less for its own sake can be simple, startling, and transformative. Imagine having a real and unhurried conversation in the midst of an unrelenting workday with someone you care about. Imagine completing one discrete task at a time and feeling calm and happy about it. In this book, I offer a new approach, what I call a less manifesto. And by the way, that my name is Lester is strictly a coincidence. Or is it? Right. I focus mostly on our work life, but the approach is equally useful for our personal life. In fact, the two hemispheres of our work and personal lives constantly reflect on and affect each other, each changing and are reinforcing the other. And while the program requires some explaining on my part and patience on yours, I promise it is simple and enjoyable. Every life has great meaning, but the meaning of our own can often be obscured by the fog of constant activity and plain bad habits. Recognize and change these, and we can again savor deeply the ways we contribute to the workplace, enjoy the sweetness of our lives, and share openly and generously with the ones we love. Less busyness leads to appreciating the sacredness of life. Doing less leads to more love, more effectiveness, and internal calmness, and a greater ability to accomplish more of what matters most, to us and by extension, to others and the world. I don't know how many of you saw, I think it was back a few months ago, there was an article, it was on the editorial page by David Brooks, the conservative writer, columnist. He wrote a piece called The Neural Buddhists. Any of you see this piece? Oh, it was a great piece, and very surprising that it was by David Brooks, who mostly was someone who I, you know, always felt agitated about because he was supporting the Iraq War. And but there he was writing this article called The Neural Buddhists, and he was describing this all this neuroscience that has come out, and about how one of the really interesting things that neuroscientists are finding is that this sense of sacredness and connection is something that is programmed in it's in our brains. Scientists are finding this is something that is in all of us. And I thought this was really startling coming from David Brooks. And it's an article worth looking at called The Neural Buddhist. You can look it up on the New York Times. And it also reminds me, one of the things that I've been doing is teaching. I teach a class at Google called Search Inside Yourself. And this is a mindfulness and meditation class kind of wrapped in emotional intelligence. And one of the things that we've learned that we need to do at each of the classes is start with brain science. We need to start by showing. There's a tremendous amount of research happening now showing that what we already know, right? How useful meditation and mindfulness practice is, but brain science is now showing how by sitting, by letting go of all of this busyness and extraneous stuff in our lives, and just practicing being aware, and practicing with mindfulness and meditation, it literally changes the makeup in our brains, and it tends to particularly increase the parts of our brains that feels sacredness and more connected, more centered, and tends to reduce the way that we react and makes us less reactive, more responsive. Yeah, so this... how do we, you know, this? The question that I pose is, well, how do we appreciate our lives? How can we use this practice to bring our lives alive? And how can we actually go about reducing our fears? And you know, there's this famous quote by Eihei Dogen, who was the founder of Zen in Japan in the 13th century. And he says to study Buddhism is to study yourself, and to study yourself is to forget yourself. I've noticed most of us do just the opposite, right? We don't study ourselves, right? Instead, we get really busy, and things that are difficult, we ignore. We're really good at things. I mean, I sometimes say that I have a PhD in denial. I'm really good at denial, and also I'm excellent in compartmentalization. In fact, I was explaining this to my daughter the other day, how good I am at compartmentalization, and that this is part of my practice is over and over again noticing when I'm not paying attention, when I'm denying my own feelings, when I'm denying what's difficult, and when I'm putting things in boxes in a way that it's not appropriate. Now, I know a lot of people who could use more compartmentalization. You know, sometimes you see people who are always creating drama. And so compartmentalization is one of those things that we all compartmentalize to a certain extent, but it's partly paying attention and seeing where we all fall in these categories. So this practice is about studying ourselves, the practice of studying ourselves and knowing what our tendencies are, and that we tend not to do that. We tend to find ways to... we all tend to avoid what's difficult. You know, one of the things in this class at Search Inside Yourself, one of the books we're using is a Goleman text called Emotional Intelligence at Work. And one of the later chapters in this book is called The Billion Dollar Mistake. And he's referring to how when organizations liked this idea of emotional intelligence and saw that it had great possibility in their organizations, and they spent millions and billions of dollars having trainers bring it in and teach it, but they were all teaching it as though it were computer science. And he calls it the billion-dollar mistake because it totally didn't work. Emotional intelligence didn't work because it's not like computer science. It actually requires looking at what's difficult in our lives. It requires bringing up, looking at, and being with over and over again our own emotional pain and difficulty, much like we do every time. This is what meditation practice is. This is sitting with whatever happens to be in our lives. I also, as I was preparing for this talk, I was reading various texts by Suzuki Roshi, and one of the quotes from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says, "So when you practice Zazen, Zen meditation, there is no idea of time or space. You may say, we started sitting at 5:45 in this room. Thus you have some idea of time and some idea of space. Actually, what you are doing, however, is just sitting and being aware of the universal activity. That is all. Time and space are one. You may say, I must do something this afternoon, but actually, there is no this afternoon. We do things one after the other. That is all." So this is moving on to the second part of... So Dogen says, right, he says to study yourself, to study Buddhism is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget yourself. So most of us do the opposite on the second part. We don't forget ourselves. We're always remembering all of the difficult things and attaching over and over again to the fears and anxieties and difficulties. So it's good to keep in mind these two practices of studying ourselves and forgetting ourselves as ways of being. And there's a lot of different practices and things that we can do to do this. For example, we can explore not knowing. We can explore what I think of as doubt, the practice of doubt and curiosity. This is something that you can experiment with during meditation or through your day, the practice of what in Zen practice it's often called the practice of don't know. And over again you can repeat to yourself quietly, just don't know, or don't know. Because we get into so much trouble when we think we know. So like Suzuki Roshi is saying here, well, we all know about time and space. It's 8:35 and we're here in this room. Well, this is true, but what if we loosen our ideas about these things that we take for granted? I had an experience just a few weeks ago that continues to greatly impact my life. I was sitting on my couch, minding my own business. Actually, I happened to be sipping a glass of wine when I felt a pretty strong jolt in my heart, which was really, really unusual. And I was sitting, my wife was also sitting on the couch, and she could see me kind of lurch up. I sat, it was strong enough that it sat me up straight. And she said, "What was that?" And I said, "No big deal."
Me the opportunity to fix it because it's
Thank
driving
you.
Me nuts.
Thank you. Great. Thank you very much. So I could feel this pain in my heart. She said, "What was that?" I said, "Oh, no big deal, just a little heart flutter." And about 30 seconds or 45 seconds later, I could feel myself starting to lose consciousness. And the combination of heart pain, starting to lose consciousness, I assumed that these were my last breaths. That I could I thought I was dying, and it was very powerful. That 30 to 45 seconds, I'm not sure how long it was, of going from being conscious to feeling myself lose consciousness, and very quickly the world became divided into what was important and what was not important. And it was really interesting to notice what was over on the not important side was money and bank accounts, worries and problems and all things unfinished. I must not have big enough ears. Maybe that. And on the side of there, on the side of what was important, were things like love and appreciation. I could feel my family and good friends. I was also, one of the things that surprised me over on the side of what mattered was that I had completed my book. and I could also, of course, I also had the thought of, oh, I'm a Zen priest. I always teach and write about life and death, but isn't this different feeling it? And that I could feel this sense of terror at the same time that I was feeling this sense of tremendous love and appreciation for my life. And that incident continues to impact me. It seems that I was suffering from being way too relaxed, that I had a lot of physical exercise that day and hadn't eaten very much, and then a little bit of alcohol seems to have lowered my blood pressure. So I was unconscious for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and I woke up, and I was really surprised to see all these emergency room technicians in my living room. It was so like, what are you guys doing here? I'm fine, it was my first trip to the emergency room, and I went through all the tests, and I found out I have a really strong, healthy heart, and I found out that I need to eat more. I can't go the day without not eating anything. So in Buddhist teaching, there's what are called the three marks. These are the three categories that it's said that if these three things are not all present, it's not a Buddhist teaching. And these three categories are impermanence, no self, and awakening. And I want to kind of present these as three practices for appreciating our lives and three practices for reducing fear. Right, so impermanence is the seeing what is, right? This was, in a way, this experience that I had of losing consciousness I got a whole different feeling of impermanence. I got a very poignant sense of how impermanent my own life was, that feeling like this might be the last breath that I'm taking. And this is, you know, this, and in a way, one way that meditation practice, zazen practice, is described as we want to be so focused and present with our breath that when we breathe out each time in meditation, that we don't take for granted that our next in-breath will be there. That this is really what meditation practice, when we're, and I think when we sit for long periods of time, we, you know, during these, if we do a one-day sitting or longer retreats, we can get more into that, enter that space. That's partly what makes those long sittings so powerful. But we can do it even sitting for short periods of time. So this practice of impermanence. The practice of no self is really seeing, really becoming familiar with all of our various voices that we have. This is a way to practice with no self, is to again, going back to this, it's a little bit paradoxical, but it's like studying ourselves, becoming more and more, the more familiar we are with all of the voices that reside within us, the more we see that none of those voices is quite us. None of them can be possibly identified as having some self. Even though we really, really put a lot of energy into how we define ourselves. And even in a way, even more interesting to practice with is to see that this no self actually applies to other people as well, right? That we, our minds so quickly kind of create ideas and conceptions about who other people are, and we start to treat them that way, much more like our conceptions about them than as someone without a self, someone who is made up of many, many voices, someone who we actually don't know what they're going to say or who they are. This third piece of awakening or enlightenment or nirvana, this is the practice of knowing that finding real freedom from our small relative mind is possible. Right, that we can actually hang out and live in this, what in Zen is called big mind, or in the realm of the absolute. Right, so much of our fear and so much of our not appreciating being alive is often based around our sense of time and feeling like that we're always on this treadmill, always, right? We're always worrying about the future, worrying about what we've done, and not making enough space for time that isn't relative time, which would be more of an absolute time. And this is very much related to this idea of finding real freedom and believing that there is a way to find real freedom in our lives. One of the metaphors that I like in describing this, it's somehow we all have a way of creating our own prisons. We kind of imprison ourselves through our fears and conceptions. And then, unfortunately, what we tend to do in practice is, you know, we think that freedom is, we want to change the circumstances, right? So we think, you know, that just by moving the furniture around in our prison, this would be freedom. So if we only had more money, or if we only had this relationship, if we only had these circumstances, as opposed to practicing with living and breathing and being in a place where real awakening is possible, where real freedom is possible. I'm going to stop for a moment there because I'm aware of the time. And I want to try something. I would like to ask you all to find a partner. So maybe just turn to someone next to you. Find a partner. No talking yet. Let's silently find a partner. Silently. Back, find a partner back there. Does everyone have a partner? Yes? We good? Anyone need a partner? Don't be shy. There's two people that need partners. Are we an even number of people? So here's what I want us to do. Each grouping is going to have just a few minute conversation. But not just any old conversation. This is going to be, I'm going to suggest a topic to talk to each other about. But I want to suggest that you experiment, if you're the person speaking, that you experiment with just saying whatever comes up. This can be confidential, right? Whatever's said in this room can stay in this room. So that you feel some freedom to just speak about whatever is in your heart in this moment without, you don't need to impress your partner. If you're the person listening, notice that you are listening and don't be preparing for what you're going to say. Most of you have probably already prepared for what you're going to say and haven't even asked you anything. I've purposely not put it out there because that's actually a form of fear, right? Is we're afraid that we won't have anything to say. Trust me, you will have something to say. And if you don't, it's okay. So both pay attention to your own speaking and your own listening. I suggest that what you speak about is how do you practice with fear? How do you practice with fear? And if there were less fear in your life, how might that impact your actions and your choices? So how do you practice with fear? And what might your life be like if fear were greatly reduced in your life? Okay? Any questions? So let's take a moment just to relax and breathe. And just again, I suggest you not prepare. Don't see if you can. This is like saying don't think of an elephant, right? Don't worry about what you're going to say. Just take a breath, relax, settle yourself. We'll need to keep voices down so we don't have to yell in this space. So be aware of voices down. You can get really close to the person next to you. So again, I'm going to give this about a total of 4 minutes, for both people. So make sure I will announce when there is 1 minute left. So both people need to get a chance to speak. Have a little conversation about how you practice with fear. I'll ring a bell at the end of 4 minutes. Go ahead. Come on back, please. Anything that surprised anybody about that you want to say, please.
Did I speak for 4 minutes?
And your partner didn't speak at all?
No. And I thought it was a talk, but I was getting along, but I went back to saying everything from my mind.
I'm sure it was, you clearly needed to say something. And your partner needed to listen, yes. You didn't switch either.
I don't think I understood what the bell was.
Uh-huh.
I think you said one more minute.
Right.
Uh-huh. My bad. I was given strict instructions that we have to end at 9 o'clock. So you can talk afterwards. anything else other than that you totally didn't understand the instructions? Anything else that anyone wants to share about what happened?
Useful stuff. This I think so many of our lives are ruled by fear. And what if this? And what if that? Mm. And there's so many what ifs. What if this? Whether it be health or money or the future. Instead of worrying about things in the past, I'm worrying about things that might happen in the future. But the ability to be in the here and the now, when you said no other place than here, no other time than now, it really, I guess the word is resonated. It really absorbed it.
So you think you think other people feel that other than you?
Everybody. The two other guys talked to just now.
Yes. No. Yes. No. This is the human epidemic.
Yes. Life is just filled with fear, and it doesn't have to be.
Right.
The ability to let go of all those fears is easier said than done.
Yes. 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 Did you want to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say that it would be helpful if you wait for the mic. But I'm afraid I was a little too late.
Yes, one more comment.
I heard there, I don't know if it's a scientific fact or a study, that 99% of the things that we fear don't come to pass. I just heard that, and I think maybe my mom told me some years back. And the other thing is...
Yeah, but it's the 1% that would get you.
Right. And then the other thing, during my course of discourse and my unraveling of my words into my partner's ear, it was benefiting me. I was listening to my own words, I was listening, and I started to come to terms of the subject matter, and I was actually extracting things that were, I was learning. That's as great. I was speaking the words, I was learning a lesson.
Great, thank you. So I want to thank you very much, and my apologies for the confusion. But it's good for us all, I think. I want to finish just by reading a couple of paragraphs from the epilogue of this book, which starts with a quote that I'm sure most or all of you have heard from Shunryu Suzuki. "You are perfect just as you are, and you can use a little improvement." A doctor friend I have known for many years was recently severely injured in a head-on collision with a driver who had a seizure on the Golden Gate Bridge. It's actually, some of you may know this woman who lives at Green Gulch. She broke nearly every bone in her body and was in a coma for several months. It is a miracle that she not only has survived, but appears to be in the process of a nearly complete recovery. In her online journal, she writes with a sense of deep knowing and powerful urgency. And this is something I caught from her online journal. "We must remember to get on with our lives. Do what is important. If you haven't been married, get married. If you need to get divorced, get divorced. Just do what is essential and important. That is what matters." And then this is the very last paragraph of the book says, "At the same time, we must embrace the paradox that despite being perfect, we can all use a little improvement. Needing improvement does not make us less perfect, just the way we are. Instead, this idea simply recognizes that nothing is stagnant, everything is changing. There is always the possibility for developing more awareness in this moment. We can almost always develop ways to work better and increase our effectiveness. We can always find more ways to benefit others and improve our lives and our world. This is why we are on this planet. Of course, change brings the possibility of pain, of failure, and of new problems to solve. May you meet them too with less effort, more composure, more effectiveness, and greater joy." So I know that it's important to Gil and people that there's no sales of any kind here, so don't buy this book. It is available on Amazon, and not that I pay any attention to these things, but I will be checking the Amazon rankings as soon as I get back, and letting them go with great. Anyhow, it's been a great pleasure to be here with all of you. Thank you all very much.